Sorry, I asked people for ideas to talk about, and somebody, I think Goran, mentioned a chapter in the Shoborgenzo, which you're looking at week by week in London, Genjo Koan. I'm not going to talk specifically about that, although I can another time, not this morning. But the study itself, because in my van I brought with me two crates of books, which I don't want anymore, and they're all on Buddhism, and as I took them out the bookshelf and put them into the crates, I thought, oh wow, what a lot of study. I must have read most of them. I don't know whether I've read all of them. And then looking back on the 40 years I've been involved with the Shoborgenzo, what a lot of study that is. And I suppose one characteristic of Buddhism is study of Buddhism. It's a very interesting subject. Partly because recently, more and more clearly, I begin to wonder whether some people don't mistake the study of Buddhism for what Buddhism is about. It's very easy to do. I'm studying, you know, this person or that person or this old master or that old master. But what's that old master studying? You know, if we study Shoborgenzo, for example, we're studying what a guy wrote in the 13th century. But what did he write about? He didn't write about the 13th century. He wrote about his life, his experience, there and now, here and now then. And coming back to this central tenet of Buddhism is in the word Buddha. Buddha is the past participle of the verb bud, Sanskrit verb bud, which means to wake up. So Buddha means woken up, or someone who has woken up. We'll have to think about what we wake up to. But it's interesting to look at the difference between the assertion that Buddhism is about waking up and what study is about. Is study about waking up? Is reading books about waking up? Quite interestingly, Dogen himself, in some of his writings, you can notice that he doesn't talk about books. There weren't books in the 13th century. He talks about sutras, kyo in Japanese. And a sutra would have been written on a scroll with parchment or even animal hide and rolled up. And it's obvious if you read his thoughts about sutras that he doesn't, to him, sutras are not just written stuff. He has a view which is much wider than that. To him, nature is a sutra. A tree can be a sutra. Fences, walls, tiles and pebbles can be sutras. But in modern life, we tend to separate our experience from our study of that experience. And we do so far more than happened in, for instance, Japan and China back in the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. We've learned to separate intellectual knowledge, study, which is knowledge accumulated in our brain somewhere from our experience. Those of you who have tried to understand the Shobo Genzo, I'm certain you've come across something that I came across many times. That is, you read it and read it and read it, and you think and you try and get the meaning out of it, but you can't understand it. And you can respond in different ways. You can buy another book written, translated by somebody else, and read that, and then do the same again and the same again, and compare them all, try and get the meaning out of it. Or another way is to do what Dogen himself suggests, which is to study and experience. That's his phrase. It's two Japanese kanjis that he puts together to make this term, which he uses a lot, which really means closing the book, stopping trying to understand, and trying to see whether you can see anything in your own experience which slightly or more than slightly matches what he's written. Well, quite a difficult task, of course. But nevertheless, certainly in modern times, we tend to try to tease the meaning out of the words ad infinitum and frustrate ourselves in the process. And there's a rather nice little story in Dogen wrote a chapter called Kankin, or Reading Sutras, if I can find it. Kankin, yeah. It's in the end of book one. Kankin means reading sutras. And the introduction by my teacher, Nishijima Roshi, says, many Buddhist sects revere reading sutras because they think that the Buddhist truth is theory which can be understood through abstract explanations. They think we can understand Buddhism only by reading sutras. At the same time, there are other sects who deny the value of reading sutras. They say because Buddhist truth is not a theoretical system, we cannot attain the truth by reading sutras. Master Dogen took the middle way on the problem. Rather than deny the value of reading sutras, he said that reading sutras is one way of finding out what Buddhist practice is. He did not believe, however, that we can get the truth by reading sutras. And the interesting little story the ancestral patriarch, Great Master Kodo of Yakusen Mountain, does not usually let people read sutras. One day, he is reading a sutra himself. So you can imagine him sitting on the veranda of a Japanese temple in the 10th century or something, reading a sutra. A monk asks him, "The master does not usually let others read sutras. Why then are you reading yourself?" The master said, "I just need to rest my eyes." The monk says, "May I copy the master?" The master says, "If you were to read, you would surely pierce holes even in the oxhide." The oxhide would be the scroll on which it was written. This suggests a student of a Buddhist teacher who's so trying so hard to understand his eyes pierce what is written. He's looking and looking and looking to find the meaning. But a master who just rests his eyes on the words. And that's quite an important little story there. It suggests that maybe we don't need to make so great intellectual efforts when we're studying, particularly the Shobo Genzo in our case. I guess we'll just burn holes in the pages. So maybe we could just rest our eyes on the words, read a chapter, close the book, reflect on it. I mean, nobody really knows how we learn. Do we learn by reading something, understanding it, and that's it, finished? Or do we learn by looking at something, puzzling about it, going away, doing something else, coming back and realizing something? Words, well, in this case, Chinese characters. Last week, I was reading a book, which I'm reading at the moment, which is the autobiography of Václav Havel, who was Prime Minister of the Czech Republic after communism collapsed. And he was a playwright and an artist, and he became Prime Minister, which is quite a weird thing. And I was just reading through it because I'm interested in, and I came across this paragraph which he wrote. "The beauty of language is that it can never capture precisely what it wants. Language is disconnected, hard, digital, as it were. And for that reason, but not only for that reason, it can never completely capture something as connected as reality, experience, or our souls. This opens the door to the magnificent battle for expression and self-expression that has accompanied man down through history. It's a battle without end, and thanks to it, everything that is human is continually being elucidated, each time somewhat differently. Moreover, it is in this battle that man in fact becomes himself, as an individual and as a species. He simply tries to capture the world and himself more and more exactly through words, images, or actions. And the more he succeeds, the more aware he is that he can never completely capture either the world or himself, nor any part of the world. But that itself drives him to keep trying again and again, and thus he continues to define himself more and more exactly. It's a Sisyphean state, a fate, but it can't be helped. Man will carry the complete truth about himself to the grave, though someone in the end will know that truth after all. If not the Lord God, then at least the great memory of being." I think that's a very wise description of language by somebody from whom you wouldn't expect that kind of wisdom. If anybody wants to read it again, it's here. So, coming back to this centre of this rather rambling theme, why do we read books? Why do we study, particularly Buddhism? What do we hope to get from it? What is being awake? Which seems to be the beginning of it all. Can we waken ourselves up by reading? All these questions we should reflect in experience, as Dogen would say. We can't find out about ourselves through books alone, although books may reflect something to us. particularly the kinds of writing that many of the ancient Buddhist masters used, is not the kind of writing that you can read and logically understand. Part of that is because the language they wrote in itself is pictorial, little tiny squiggles, kanji, Chinese characters, which has some kind of different effect to reading logical sentences in logical Western languages, where everything is logical, and if it's not logical, we feel, oh, that's not right. And this happens again and again in, if you read translations of the Shobo Genzo, you say, that sentence doesn't make sense. Okay, well, why should it make sense? Well, because everything should make sense, shouldn't it? Well, why should everything make sense? We need to ask these questions and answer them for ourselves. Does a sentence need to make sense? And if it doesn't make sense, does it still have value? So that's the theme I've introduced today. And maybe you can expand it, comment on it, talk about it, not talk about it. Pardon? Power technology.
You don't dare to talk on this.
Why don't you dare to talk?
Because it's on.
So what will it do?
Talking already.
Okay, okay. We'll capture a record of what you say.
Well, I was wondering, I know this topic of importance or not importance of studying was mentioned before by you several times, and even during the very first retreat at the Anamkara, which I attended, I think you were talking about this, that studying reading is not absolutely necessarily. And I felt resistance then, and I still feel it. And it's not because I don't trust your experience or what you say. No, it's just internal resistance, which is quite strong. I now physically feel it, the rising inside. You know, it's if now, if anything changed in 2 years, that now I can probably identify it a little bit better than I was then, right?
Okay.
But it's still resistance to what you are saying, that study is not important. And I was wondering whether...
Did I say study is not important?
Well, no. That's how I hear it. Yeah, and I was just wondering if words are again to blame, because in English language you have two verbs, study and learn. When I'm thinking of Russian language, I think we only have one, учиться. I can't think of second word to translate this two. We would use the same word to translate
okay,
both study and learn.
Образование.
But no, it's different. Образование is the education, that's different. So for study and learn, we have the same word. So maybe my resistance is coming from that perception. If you say you don't really need to study hard to
it
learn,
means you don't need,
and then I'm lost because for me it's the same.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's just a guess. It's just something which came to my mind whilst you were talking. It might be, oh, but it could be again due to words and to how we actually label things in words. Just a thought.
Yes, an important one too. Because I now realise that what you heard me say was not, you don't need to study, and what else did you say? Well, and I don't remember saying those. So I can see how what I'm saying comes over.
No, you didn't say that you don't need to study. You said that it's not
necessary. Did I say that?
I don't know. No.
Strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
One thing about the written word is we can go back over it again and again.
Yeah.
So if somebody transcribes this tape, we can go back and say, what did he say, and what did Eliana say, and okay.
I was wondering about that, though, kind of the early, when the guys that first encountered these teachings, whether they would have actually read it as a written word, or whether they would have heard it read. I mean, certainly in the early, right back to the first 500 years of Buddhism, nothing was written down, but everything was just learned by rote.
I think not only then,
but I think maybe in Dogen's time, a lot of the guys who encountered that wouldn't be able to read.
Yes, they? Absolutely.
So I think it's a very different way of receiving information as to hear it.
Yes.
If you learn stuff, I think in my experience, kind of learning stuff by rote as a kid, you weren't at all, you didn't question what it making sense of it, what it didn't mean anything. It was just you just had to learn, get the sound of it in your head and see
yes.
it and everything. And it works on you in a very different way. I mean, I wish I'd had more of that now as a kid now, because I've got you know, a couple of passages from Shakespeare in my head, and it's, you know, and then over the years, it's kind of, it's there in your subconscious, and it, you're not sort of thinking about it or analysing it, but it kind of affects you in a different way. And I wonder if a lot of Buddhist teaching worked like that on people, and sort of...
Well, certainly, most of Dogen's students in his temple that he built, Eheiji, were... from the countryside. It's very doubtful whether they could read.
Yeah.
So what he did was he gave talks, different kinds of talks, formal talks and then more informal talks. And then he wrote essays. Sometimes it's clear which is which in the record we have of what he did. Sometimes it's not clear. It's difficult to, for instance, imagine how somebody would have recorded him giving a talk. Were they writing furiously with a brush? You know, maybe they were. So, it's a good question. Something else which I'd like to talk about sometime during the weekend, the koan stories, which Dogen himself collected 300 of them to discuss. The koan stories we have in a book. I edited a book of the Dogen's collection, ancient Chinese records of conversations between masters and disciples, like that little one I read out. Why were they like that? Why are all these stories written down? Some of them sound most peculiar, some of them illogical, some of them very nice. Well, they were a way to record teachings. Whereas in the modern world, what we try and do is extract a general principle from something almost before it's finished. And you can see this in modern life. Something happens, and some catastrophe happens, and immediately the society around it has to learn the lesson. Well, to learn the lesson from a catastrophe is to generalize from it, you know, and then extrapolate into the future so it doesn't happen again. But that way of learning, because it is a way of learning, didn't exist in Dogen's time and before. People didn't read, try to extrapolate general principles from their experience and then write them down and then use those general principles. They did it in an intuitive way, but Dogen was one of the very first people to try and do that. So his writings are very unusual in as much as he does do that to some extent. But the koan stories are simple records of conversations. You read the conversations and you get a feeling of what the teaching was. But it's not written clearly what the teaching was. It's hidden in the story.
I wonder if we can go back to that story of Master Kodo in Kankin. And think about the kind of what that scene looked like
Yeah.
Act it out.
Okay. I'll be Master Kodo.
So, Master Kodo, how are you holding this scroll that you're reading?
Like this.
Mm. So it's going to be between you and the sun. I think I've seen, the translation that you read, you said, I need to rest my eyes.
Yeah.
I think I've seen it translated, I'm shading my eyes.
Shading my eyes,
yeah. So you could literally be shading your eyes, couldn't you? So there's something about the physicality of this sutra is between you and the light.
Could be.
Yeah. It's blocking out that. So we're playing with enlightenment, with vision, with waking up and seeing clearly, with shading the eyes.
Could be. It's possible. Most of Dogen's commentary.
And putting it and then putting it down in order to actually look at. So I'm the monk. What are you going to do with the sutra when I start talking to you? And put it down and look at me. Just see what I mean? I think
possibly,
there's something
not.
Being acted out in this story about where we are in relation to the sutras.
Okay, well this is a very nice example of what I said about generalizing.
And how they can obscure us.
You are generalizing from the story, which is what
I'm imagining the particularity of the story. I'm imagining what it actually looks like between two embodied people. Actually having that conversation, generalising from it.
Yes, and?
So when that contrast that you made between piercing the manuscript and your eyes resting on it and putting it on the side is just one of the things that they're doing with that manuscript. If we actually thought about what these two people in their bodies would be actually doing with it. There are some other contrasts too between two people not looking at each other because there's a sutra in the way and a sutra enabling two people to actually look at each other.
That's one possible way of embroidering the story, yes.
That doesn't sound like a complimentary word.
Well, it is. You have embroidered it, haven't you? You've taken a very simple story and you've put lots of other things around it, the possibilities. But the student is saying, you don't allow us to read sutras and you're reading them, aren't you? What's going on? And what the master says is nothing to do with I'm looking at you. Is what he's saying is, yes, but I'm just resting my eyes on them. We'd have to look up the kanji for shading to see whether it has a wider meaning. So can I rest my eyes on the sutra too? Well, no, because you can't rest your eyes on it. You'll just burn into it. It's a simple story. Now, we can embellish that and get lots more meaning out of it, it's true. But to me, that's a very, very nice example of how we generalise. We take a story or a sentence and we see all other kinds of deeper, we say deeper, I don't quite know what deeper might mean, deeper meanings. Yes, very nice, thank you.
Because the master's actually saying, don't, if you pierce through it, you're trying to get too deep into the words on the paper. Whereas,
it's kind of humorous way, isn't it? Because he's obviously said to the students, no, don't read, just practice.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly why. Maybe they're all, you know, saying, oh, we want to read, we want to understand.
Yeah.
But we don't know that.
Characters for learn in Chinese, sometimes you use just one word, which is learn. Most of the time you use learn and practice together.
Yeah.
So it makes sense, because you're learning, but you have to practice it.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that's a bit different from the Western way of thinking.
Yes.
they always use that term, learn, practice, learn, practice.
Yes, Dogen does.
Yeah.
So without an and in between.
Yeah, this is, yeah, it's
yes.
Two characters.
And that's a very big difference between what you can do in a language like Japanese, Chinese, Korean, and what you can do in a Western language.
Mm.
The structure is different. We have already separated concepts, and then we have to paste them back together again with ands, things like that. But in Chinese or Japanese, for example, we can stick them. We can stick them together, and they're more of a unit.
Mm.
It's true. But of course, in an English translation, it's gone.
Yeah.
Already gone.
I think notebooks, even notebooks, they call it like learn practice notebook. Yeah, like practice.
In modern Chinese, for example.
Yeah. Like school, you know, like for kids.
Yeah.
It's like learn practice book.
Yeah. Well, the big example for in the area of Buddhism is Shinjin, heart, mind. Or body and mind, sorry. Shin means body, and shin also means mind, but it's a different character. And in the Japanese or Chinese, you can put the two together to represent the fact that our mental area and our physical area are one. That suggests not taking two areas that are separate and joining them together again, but indicating that they've never been separate, which is very different. However, Western civilization has already made the separation, and this is reflected in our language. We've already made the separation, and it's very difficult for us to take it away again.
Can I make a comparison, kind of, to the story that you were saying? Sometimes, like, say if you're going hiking, walking, and we look at an OS map, and we're looking deeply into this OS map,
yeah,
trying to translate what we imagine it to be like, but
yeah,
we have no idea because we've never been there.
Yeah.
So we study it and study it. So put the map away, and we set off to do a hike, get lost along the way, a few
yeah
trips. A few experiences, but really, initially, we had no full understanding of that OS map. But then we come back from a walk, and then we look at the OS map again, and we have a greater understanding of it because we've experienced and practiced some of the paths, some of the wrong turns, and it's clearer. Is that, in a way, kind of similar to the story that you were saying, where he's resting his eyes, he's already experienced or practiced, and the words, the sutras that he's looking at are familiar to his life experiences, so he's not having to look too deeply into them anymore, unlike the student who hasn't set on the path.
Maybe.
That's, yeah. For me, that's a kind of similarity in what it sounds to be going across.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe he's just read so many sutras.
Maybe the master read this sutra so many times that he knows it by heart, and he just holds it deep just to shade his eyes and rest his eyes.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. There's all these possibilities. But what is the sutra telling him to do? What if you read a paragraph, and there is a paragraph in the Shobo Genzo, it says, words on this page are not helping you. Wake up. There is a sentence in the Shobo Genzo. The words on this page are no help at all. Help at all for what? Well, we have to come back to this waking up. or awakened being or enlightened being or whatever, which is a huge subject in Buddhist studies. What does it mean to be awake? I've talked about this before with people in London. Is it something special that only a few people are ever awake? But we should discuss that later.
Have some experience of another religion where text study is quite important.
Where what?
I have some experience of another religion where text study.
Text study
is quite important. Like in Judaism, you're supposed to study text.
Yes.
You usually do it in pairs. Like you read some short paragraph together, then you say what you mean, it means, another person says what that means to them, and you have this kind of discussion. So it's like a partner study, really. And it's, it doesn't really teach you how to live your life, because examples of people's behavior in ancient world that you read have nothing to do with norms of modern Orthodox Judaism. People do things which are forbidden nowadays. And it's, and the laws don't really derive from that, because the laws derive from this many discussions by many different wise people, and they all disagree, and somehow one of them was picked as tradition. And that's how people behave nowadays, people who are religiously in Judaism. So it doesn't really help you to live your life, but it's just a practice that you do, and you have all these discussions, intellectual debates, and it's a language that you all seem to speak, and examples you can pick when you have a debate from there. So it's just more like a mental gymnastics, which is a practice in itself and develops your brain and your intellect. But it's not really related to living Jewish life.
Is it not?
Somehow. Not exactly. Like it's supposed to do it as part of your life, but it's not. Doesn't tell you. You're not going to understand why you don't mix, you know, meat and milk. You're not going to understand it by reading the text, because they have some strange examples of people doing things like that. Yeah, and different people's opinions will be there as well. And debating about it's not going to help you do it.
Well, it helps tell you one thing study does. It highlights the difference between study and just doing things. That happens on these retreats. We have complicated conversations, and then thankfully time is up and we go and sit. And then we have another complicated conversation, and then time is up and we go and sit. And that makes sense in my life. I edit scientific papers, which are often very complex. So I'm sitting in front of the computer, trying desperately to understand this technological research and the maths that go with it. Then I finish it, send it off, and I go downstairs and live a normal life. And then the next day I could do the same again. So it's a very nice contrast between study and practice. Study and practice. One highlights the other. I can't give you any answers. I'm just asking you to ask questions to yourself and find the answers.
You said that you brought those two cards of books which you do not want to
keep
any longer. What about books that you do want to keep? Are they?
No, I haven't got any. Pardon?
Not even Shabakans, not a single one.
Yeah, I've got a set of the books which I want to keep, because my life is in there. So, you know, it's like nice pair of shoes to keep. And
what are they? Shabakansa?
Yeah, the four volumes.
Four volumes, actually.
Yes, I have one set at home. The other, all the books that I'm giving away, I have read them. Just I don't need them anymore, because I've had them in my bookshelf, and I never take them out. And I realised there's lots of things in my house it's there as a kind of decoration. I never take it out, so I don't need it. So this is what I'm doing now, to your benefit. You can have the lot, actually. All of them, you can take them home and read them all.
You did a similar exercise some years ago, five or six years ago. You brought a box of books to retreat. And I took three of them, I haven't read any yet.
Yes, and there we are.
It's rested your eyes on the front cover.
But I have more Buddhist books on the bookshelf.
Do they
awesome.
Look nice
on
the bookshelf?
Yeah,
like
people come look at them.
I don't mean to suggest that books have no value or study has no value.
Yeah.
I don't mean that. I'm just posing the question, what is the value? What and what kind of value does study have? Because nobody quite knows how we study, how we learn yet. There are lots of theories, but educational theory goes one way and then the other. Rote learning against deep principle or whatever, backwards and forwards.
Might be an idea to test out what you think you already know as well.
Oh.
No?
Not another exam, no.
No. Practically in the world.
Go on.
Because we've got lots of life experience that we have crystallised into beliefs which may not stand up to proper examination. So you're kind of very enthusiastic to pile new stuff on top of it. You might question what you know already.
Yeah, it's difficult to do that, actually, isn't it? But that's a good point. There are lots of themes attached around this. Is the kind of wisdom that we read about that the ancient Buddhist masters had, what kind of wisdom is that? Is it a wisdom composed of wise knowledge, or is it a wisdom that's attained by not having any knowledge, or some different kind of intelligence? What is it? And we have to answer all these questions now for ourselves. Can't answer the question by reading a chapter of the Shobo Genzo. You can read a chapter of the Shobo Genzo, which may then prompt you to look at something for yourself. We have a fundamental. I'm trying to think of a word other than problem. We have a fundamental attitude in Western civilization, which is a separation of mental and physical, body and spirit, mind and body. And that's deep, deep in our culture. And therefore it's difficult even to notice that we've separated two things which other cultures may not have separated as much or at all.
I was listening to audiobook on the way here in the car, and it's called Mind Body Medicine. It's actually not even a book, it's recording of lectures, university professor lecture. And he was talking about identity and how he experiments with his students. making them to guess what is his background and who is he, basically, right? And nobody ever got it right. And then he tells his story that he was born in a very impoverished district of San Francisco. His mother was a drug addict, sex worker. At the age of 7, in order to escape from the house, he went to the library, just accidentally, just finding the shelter for himself for a while. And he liked it there, and librarians seemed like him. And it became his second home. So from the age of 7, he pretty much was raised by librarians. And that's how he became university professor. And I mean, you know, he could go on and just experience his life in the way he was born to experience. Or he could change it through this encounter with books. So I don't know why I mentioned that. But yeah, I guess again, in defense of importance of starting because it can be life-changing experience, whatever Duncan says.
And study can be a social experience. Mm-hmm. Study can be a social experience. That's what's happening there, and I guess that's what's
just,
yeah, talking
just being
about
in a quiet environment where nothing is disturbing. Interacting with adults who care about him.
I think
there's so much other experiences in here, apart from just letters on the page.
Yeah, well, but he meant that he actually discovered books.
Okay.
And that's what made him as a person,
wow.
You know, eventually. Just simply through reading books, through being there. Through this almost accidental encounter.
There you go. What will you do?
I'll get all of them.
Well, I think that suggests to me is if you see kind of reading as an enjoyable and enriching and fulfilling end in itself rather than a means to something else, you know, it's fine, and that's what it is really, but it's not going to get you anything beyond itself. You know what I mean? And I suppose it seems to me what the kind of the monk in the story was, he wanted to he felt that he was doing all this practice and wasn't sort of getting something, but it's there in the sutra, like he was hungry for that sutra,
mm-hmm.
and desperately wanted to get his hands on it. And, you know, and if we get that. And I think that's sort of what drives a lot of people's desire to study and to learn, is to sort of to get something, to whatever it is, you know. That's why there's this huge market for self-help books and this book will change your life type of literature. Isn't people want to?
Yes, it's true. Oh, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just simply that there's this book which is central to our group in a way, called The Short Book Enzo. It's a very difficult book to study. I noticed that there are many groups all over the place who, I feel, may be mistaking studying what somebody wrote in the 13th century as a study for what that person in the 13th century is trying to tell me. So you can become a Shobo Genzo expert, for example, or you can become a Buddhist expert without ever having woken up, whatever waking up is. There are lots of excellent Buddhist scholars, academics, excellent. They've uncovered very important facts about the lives and histories of practitioners down through the ages. Those books are interesting to read. They're fascinating, and we can remember those facts. Dogen went to China when he was 40 years old, was it? He died when he was 53, you know, he's blah, 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 blah. And then all the other masters. And, but is that what it's about? I'm just asking you to answer that question. I don't mean you should stop. Just, is that what it's about? And if that's not what it's about, getting knowledge about the Shomogenza, then what is it about?
I remember reading a book called Zen and Reality, a very tiny book.
Yeah.
I can't remember who it's written by, a very long time ago. And it occurred to me then that it took me an awful long time to get through it, because every sentence seemed to be saying to me, put this book down and walk away from it and actually go out and live this and forget about what you're reading. So therefore, it was very difficult to read a whole page at a time, because every sentence was telling me to stop reading it.
Right. Did you?
It took me a long time to finish the book, yes.
Took you a long time to stop reading it?
No, because I couldn't stop it. And no, I couldn't tell you anything about the book. I still have it on my bookshelf.
What time do we stop? Another 5 minutes.
There's some name in philosophy for words, for concepts, which if you don't argue about them, that means you're not talking about them. Like, it's impossible to agree on a definition. And one of them is creativity. Like, if you don't argue what creativity is, then you're just not really having a conversation about it.
Yes.
Remember what this word is. If I could just name them, of course, everything would be perfect. Yeah, and I think there's something similar in that passage from Maslow Pavlov that you read.
Yes.
Yeah, just there's some concepts of Chayan Shomogenza which we have to keep talking about to define, to seriously define them.
You have to define them.
Yeah, like, in order to define them, you have to have a debate. Like, it's like you have to have a, if you define them, it means you're not talking about them. But if you're debating what it is, that means you are talking about it.
What about looking at the nature of language itself? Because if you're kind of batting words back and forth, then...
Yeah, then...
Because philosophers, particularly modern ones, kind of just tend to try and find a story that they agree on. And it's still verbal. It's still a story.
Yeah. The language is just discrete, as we heard.
Yes,
basically. So things fall through the cracks, and if you keep talking about it, then you have less cracks that way.
That's true.
It's
yes.
very different from painting. You know, it's very easy
That's
for
true.
Computers to paint nowadays,
yeah.
to generate paintings, because you can just do something which is kind of true.
Yeah.
You don't have to get it exactly right. Well, it's very hard for computers to generate text. It's really hard because it's discrete, and if you just get one thing off, the whole sentence collapses. While in a kanji, if you just slightly get a little curve, then it still sort of makes sense.
Yes, it may be important to debate, but it's rather like saying, let's have a conversation about where does my finger end
mm-hmm.
and my hand begin? And, you know, we can talk a lot about that. All I'm saying is that what it's about. For Václav Havel, it was his life. He was a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
Words were his life. So he says that investigating and using words helps us define ourselves. I don't disagree with that at all. But there's a difference between saying, my finger ends there. Oh, no, it doesn't. It ends there. Or whatever, and holding something in my hand. They're dimensionally different. So all I'm saying is discussing what Dogen wrote or discussing what Buddhism is dimensionally different from waking up. And what is waking up? And what relation does that bear to discussing it? That's all. I'm not doing it in a very ordered, logical way. And I'm not giving any answers. I don't know them.
But you're saying that the person who tells me an answer, who tells me what waking up is not really talking about waking up.
Maybe. But if studying, reading Dogen's works and discussing doesn't explain to you what waking up is, then what was all that about? It's about accumulating knowledge about Dogen, was it?
Yeah,
no, it's just very tempting to believe that there is a person or there was a person who actually knew something. Everything, or I don't know. If you read and study long and hard enough, something might drop off, and you might just get a little tiny glimpse of what is it.
Might. In the last sentence on the last page of the last book you read.
So I'm not in it. Are you? It's all right.